Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host, Fridays and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking to Khalid Abu El-Fadel, professor of Islamic law at the UCLA Law School, and we're discussing Bernard Lewis's book, What Went Wrong. Glad to have you on the show today.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a sense of the central theses of Lewis's book, What Went Wrong.
Lewis, I believe, wrote his book before 9/11, but he says in the introduction that 9/11 occurred and while the book was in process of print. And his basic argument, well, one is that something went wrong in the history of Islam, and he tries to identify, to describe what he means by something went wrong. Two, he tries then to identify causes. And his basic argument is a bit ambiguous. He argues that there was an increasing closing of the Muslim mind, a sort of an increasingly confrontational paradigm, what he believes is a degree of escapism that creeps into Muslim Muslim mindset. And what he means by that is the sort of blaming others for the failures within the Muslim world. He believes that Muslims lagged far behind in technology and did not manage to figure out how to catch up in the increasingly large technological gap. He intimates, although he doesn't say it explicitly, he intimates that part of the failure was in not adopting a secularist paradigm for the modern world, because he gives Turkey as sort of the example of a successful model. And as of course is well known, Turkey is a staunchly secularist state. That's basically his short argument.
I wonder, maybe to put the show in perspective, I wonder if you could begin by saying a little bit what you see as any strengths in this book.
Well, I think that it is appropriate to pose the question of what went wrong. That doesn't exclude the possibility that we can ask what went wrong with other traditions as well. So, for instance, one of the most common reactions to this book is, well, what went wrong with the West? But I think that rather this type of defensive response is not particularly helpful. I think it is correct to say what went wrong in the sense of that Islam did create a sparkling civilization, a remarkably humanistic experiment, and that it no longer inspires the type of energetic culture that it once inspired. So I think that much is legitimate. I also think that Lewis is generally correct in that the response to the increasing technological gap between Islam and the West, that the attempt to sort of deal with that gap by insisting on sort of a vulgar way of importing Western technology, particularly in the military, was not going to make any deep structural changes that would allow Muslims to reacquire or reinvent their a vigorous sense of themselves in the modern age. And I think it is correct to say that there prevailed in the contemporary Muslim paradigm a tendency to project blame and to constantly look for someone to blame for the failures that society has been confronted with, rather than to look within and to look introspectively and self-critically.
All right. Are there parts of the book that you disagree with, find troublesome, perhaps points at which you think he omits or overstates important points that you think ought to be injected into the discussion?
Well, there's quite a bit in the sense that nearly all the examples that he draws from in his book come from a very specific period in Islamic history, and that is the Ottoman era. In many ways, Lewis is an Ottomanist, and the Ottoman Empire, yes, in some aspects it was representative of the larger experience of Islam, but in many respects it was not. And so there is, firsthand, there is this sort of a problematic methodological point that Lewis constantly refers to examples from the Ottoman Empire. The second, there is a tendency in the book, and actually in much of Lewis's work, to simplify the often rich and complex dynamics between Islam and the West. Lewis clearly looks at the paradigm between Islam and the West as one of constant conflict with little interludes of peace and actual cultural interaction. I think that is historically just inaccurate and with clear political implications. The interaction between Islam and the West, or Islam and the rest of the world, is far more complex and rich and nuanced than Lewis makes it out to be in his book. It was not simply a story of crusades and wars and occasional diplomatic missions sent by Muslims to Europe or vice versa. We have to recognize, which Lewis completely ignores, that there was a Mediterranean culture and a very deeply involved cultural and commercial and technological interaction in this Mediterranean culture, which I think demonstrates the point that the relationship between Islam and the rest of the world does not necessarily have to be or was one of clashing paradigms. Furthermore, there is an element that, granted, people such as Edward Said overdue, but nevertheless, it is important that we acknowledge it in order to get beyond it. And that is, Lewis tends to underemphasize the effect of colonialism on the Muslim world. He sees it as in many ways immaterial to the way Muslims respond to the world today. And I don't think that that's accurate. I think that colonialism has deconstructed and broken down the traditional institutions that conveyed knowledge and authority within Islam and didn't fill the void with anything that worked. And we don't. This is not just in the case of Islam, but in the case of even most of Africa, when we look at how uneasily the nation-state paradigm sit with many African countries and the resulting civil the turmoil and civil wars that are ignited. The rather remarkably strange situation where a lot of Africans, the only language they're comfortable with is French or English, substantially disconnected from their own cultural and ideological roots. And finally, I disagree very much with Lewis that Turkey can be heralded as some type of model of success. Turkey had not They created a secular religion. They replaced the religion of Islam was a deification, a practical deification of Ataturk. So till today, I mean, you can't say anything negative about Ataturk, and their human rights record and democratic practice leaves much to be desired. They started their secular paradigm with the commission of an egregious genocide against Armenians. And so in many aspects, Turkey is hardly a success story, as Lewis would like the readers to believe that it is. And also, if secularism was the, as Lewis intimates, was sort of the solution, well, Syria is a secularist country. Iraq is a secularist country. The Egypt of Nasser was a very secularist country. And I think it's just too simple to say that the challenge of modernity can be solved by a separation of church and state.
Okay, that's certainly a theme I'd like to come back and discuss later. I want to go back, though, and pick up on something you mentioned earlier. It's true by your account that Lewis is correct in saying that the proper response isn't to play the blame game. But you also think it's true that there is, in fact, some blame to be placed upon the colonializing powers. And you gave a brief account of how those interrupted and harmed and perhaps disarmed in cultural ways the Islamic countries. I wonder if you could say a bit more, maybe even give some specific examples about the way in which colonialism came to be and some of the negative effects that it has had on Islamic, particular Islamic countries, and perhaps on Islam as a whole.
It's not an exaggeration to say that it was an assault upon the world, the world that's not white. Ideologically, it was justified as the white man's burden, that the white man is going to, and here I intentionally mean white man, was going to go out and civilize the world and teach the world how they ought to really think and act and so on. And there was a race among various European powers to create spheres of influence by occupying countries. And so the players in this game was England, France, the Dutch, Italians, the Portuguese. Of course, the biggest offenders were the British and the French. The Dutch and the Italians the Portuguese were to a lesser extent. What it involved, at least in the particular specific case of Islam, was the colonial powers, sometimes there was a very intrusive model, like the French model, where they attempted to erase the local language, destroy the use of Arabic, turn the Muslim population into French mimics, or the less intrusive model of the British. But in all cases, what it involved was it dismantled many of the institutions that they were known as awqaf, which were trusts, philanthropic trusts that funded much of the religious institutions in the Muslim world. They dismantled gradually Muslim courts, the application of Islamic law in most Muslim countries. They created a class of Western educated elite that was far more comfortable with the language and the cultural paradigms of the colonizer than they were with the colonized. So, for instance, it is not unusual to find, even till today, in Algeria, that the intellectuals can't really speak Arabic. They're fluent in French. In Egypt, Egypt of the 1930s and 1940s, definitely the elite class of leaders and so on, they were far more comfortable with English than they were with Arabic. But what effects did this have? The main effect, in my opinion, is in the sharp knee-jerk defensive reaction it created. It's as if one extreme induced another extreme. It's people, as they gained independence from the colonial era, looked around and they saw that the Islam has been taken out of the most material and viable parts of life. For instance, the colonial powers created a secular law school, and people who went to law school in a secular schools could find jobs. But people who went to the religious law school, the law school that taught Islamic law, could only aspire to really be to lead prayer in mosques, which was not a very high status, extremely low salaries. So there was a very rapid and even violent alteration of the institutions of society. Now, was it done to civilize the world? I don't believe so. I think that the colonial powers had material financial interests, and that they used the excuse of civilization and democracy and so on to make these financial gains and to exploit the resources of the places they occupied. But the main side effect was that it produced as if an allergic reaction, like a foreign body that enters into a place. The allergic reaction was that people in the post-colonial era, eager to return to some authenticity, some genuine identity. The truth is that these generations, colonialism had lasted long enough for them to not know what was genuinely Islamic anymore. And what emerged was a tendency that continues still today of defining Islam as a reactive phenomena. And what I mean by that is that to define Islam as whatever the other is not. So to look at the West and to say, well, Islam must be exactly the opposite. And in doing so, by defining Islam basically in a reactive mode as being whatever the West is not, much of what was genuinely real and viable in Islam was erased. I mean, just give a quick example of that. I often, when I make arguments about tolerance or humanistic principles, and in these arguments, I always rely on classical sources that were written 600 years ago, 800 years ago. And to my great dismay, the most common response I get is that people assume, simply because I'm arguing something that is humanistic or tolerant, that I am attempting to westernize Islam. And I insist, listen, I'm relying on sources that were written 600 years ago, long before this whole issue of westernizing in Islam. So far from trying to westernize Islam, I'm trying to return to what I believe is an Islamic authenticity or genuineness. This sort of reactive, polarized mode has become so prevalent that it has injected a very irrational element in religious discourses of modern Islam. If I would identify the biggest tragedy to come out of colonialism, it would be this. I mean, and I put it this way, that people like bin Laden, for instance, or the Muslim Brotherhood, or the Jamaat Islamiyah, a lot of the Muslim fundamentalists, are far more anti-Western than they are pro-Islamic.
I wonder if you could say a little bit about what you think has happened within Islam itself that may be causing some of the problems. And then we want to move in to talk about what you see as the way out, how we might progress both within Islam and in the relationships between Islam and the West.
Well, the viable period of the Islamic civilization lasted, I mean, of course, like all civilizations, it went up and down. But when I say viable period, the period that was humanistic, the period that presented the world with a lot of science and mathematics and medicine and navigation, and presented an exchange, preserving the Greek philosophical tradition and improving upon it and so on and so forth. It went up and down, but it remained strong. It's viable civilization for about 800 years. Now, there's no question that Lewis is right in that there were internal structural problems as the Islamic civilization got old. More and more vested interests that grew old and frankly mummified, fought, resisted all forms of creativity or innovativeness or anything that was new. And if you're going to be resistant to anything that's new, it is only a matter of time before you fall seriously behind and you become so weak that you fall easy prey to colonialism. And then after colonialism, to be stuck in this paradigm of, well, we have to define ourselves as the opposite of the other, you end up losing yourself and living in an ambiguity where you no longer have a sense of who you are. What ethical values do you stand for? What moral values represent you? And then you tend to go to the easiest, and that is to define yourself politically. It's the easiest thing in the world for a person or a people to define themselves politically. It's much harder to define themselves morally and ethically. And that is what I do think is a very serious problem in many of these highly politicized, fundamentalist, Puritan, sometimes supremacist movements in many shapes and forms, that in their anxiety over the loss of an Islamic identity, they end up defining themselves in the most vulgar fashion and define themselves solidly along political lines. I have an article called Islam and the Theology of Power, where I argue that Islamic theological paradigms in the modern age have been overcome by the paradigm of power, political power, rather than the paradigm of moral power. And that's very dangerous for a religion. It might work for a government, but it's very dangerous for a religion, because a religion is, after all, if it doesn't have a moral anchor, it loses itself completely. So that is, in my view, the main problem. As to the issue of solutions, I have a recent book called The Place of Tolerance in Islam, where I talk about what I see as possible solutions, and I'm always, I talk in terms of possible, because as a believing Muslim, I believe that we have to do whatever, the best we can, and the rest must be left to God. There have been, in modern Islam, many people who are willing to kill themselves or sacrifice their lives for ugliness. People like, of course, the Qaeda or the Jihad or so on. Now, there must be people who are willing to even, if need be, martyr themselves for the sake of good, for the sake of a moral paradigm within contemporary Islam. And more concretely, the silent majority, which is moderate and humanistic and tolerant, must speak up and be counted. The way I've put it sometimes, you cannot claim to non-Muslims that you are democratically oriented or human rights oriented unless you first practice democracy internally or practice human rights or honor human rights internally. It makes no sense for us to tell others that we respect human rights but go around persecuting fellow Muslims. And that, to me, is the key. Moderate Muslims must speak out, even if it is at the risk of physical harm.
What are things that non-Muslim Westerners can do? What can we do to increase the chance that Islam will regain some of its power and prominence in the best ways, as you have described them, and that the relations between Islam and the West will improve?
Well, there are two things. One, and I know that this, it sounds simple, but it is a huge part. Every time a Western or a non-Muslim engages in or accepts the inevitability of conflict between Islam and the other. They become seriously part of the problem, and concretely why? Because it makes the life of people like me, who present theologically and juristically, sound arguments, one might even say compelling arguments, for tolerance, diversity, morality, humanism, it makes the job of people like myself, and I'm not alone, of course, very difficult when the fundamentalists respond to us by saying, well, look, listen, you keep talking about tolerance and humanism, but these guys hate us. Look at Pat Robertson and Stephen Emerson or Daniel Punch. These guys just hate us, and no matter what we do, they will always hate us. That really makes our life very difficult. Second, moderate Muslims don't have rich countries that have a ton of money that comes from the curse that Islam has been plagued with, and that is the black gold, the curse of the black gold, curse of oil. Moderate Muslims don't have such rich countries that have bought into a theology of intolerance backing them up. And so, in other words, the moderate Muslims are typically, they have too much integrity to sell out to one government or another. But at the same time, they don't have support. Support in every way. I mean, to be very, very concrete, intolerant Muslims, the bin Ladens of the world, one of the things they do, they distribute their literature for free in mosques and Islamic centers around the world for free. I mean, you go to the mosque and you find this treatise or this book or several books that just preaches hate, and it's available either for a nominal price like a dollar or for free. Why doesn't a non-Muslim go to the texts of tolerant Muslims, buy a whole bunch of copies, go to an Islamic center or in any forum they please, and give them out for free? That's doing something very concrete. Does it make a difference? You bet it makes a difference. It makes a difference, one, psychologically, in moderate Muslims not feeling that they are fighting against powers that have just an enormous amount of money, an incredible amount of fanaticism. Second, it gets the message out, and it encourages the silent majority to locate those who who empower them and give them courage to stand up and speak up. That is concretely the two things that I would urge every non-Muslim to do. Know the voices of moderate Islam and support in whichever way you can. If you can't organize a lecture and invite them to it, go buy a book, buy a magazine that they write in, distribute it, make sure it gets as wide an audience as possible. And there are a lot of moderate Muslims, I should add, that are persecuted in countries that are very authoritarian. It's quite easy for a non-Muslim to volunteer to work with a human rights organization to attempt to obtain the release of one or more of these moderate Muslims that fill up the prisons. If you just think about the number of moderate, humane Muslims that are in Saudi prisons, it's bewildering, truly bewildering.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It was my pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Khaled Abu El Fadel, professor of Islamic law at UCLA Law School, and we've been discussing Bernard Lewis's What Went Wrong. This is Ideas and Issues. Good day. Thank you.